Good evening and welcome, dear friends. Your presences are blessings for all of us as we come together with a shared intention in Christ. Our Christ candle has been lit. It is a sign and symbol of the presence of Christ that is always a light in the world, a light within our very being, through us, with us, as us, always. We know that our shared intention and attention matters. It matters for our work, for one another, for those close to us, and for all humanity. For this, we're very grateful, particularly for one another. As I was pondering this evening, it came to me that we spend a great deal of our attention and time on the season of Lent with its austerities and renunciation. And Easter is often celebrated as one glorious day of Alleluias, feast, and various gatherings and celebrations. And then we move on, and that's it. And yet, Easter is a season as well, 50 days. In fact, this is Thursday in the octave of Easter. So if Lent is about preparation and asceticisms, then what is the octave and season of Lent about? Well, it seems like it is about the resurrection life, what's like. And during those 50 days, Jesus modeled what it looked like. It was about compassion, feeding, and divine human love, expressed quietly in the small, ordinary ways of daily life. So that is our call during this time, the season of Easter. And my own wish is to celebrate it in a new and special way as a season this particular year, when we learn how to love in the midst of all. So our opening reflection comes from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who died on April 10th, 1955. For us this year, it was Good Friday. For him, it was Easter Sunday. And this is what he offers us for our time. Above all, trust in the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient in everything to reach the end without delay, to skip the intermediate stages, impatient of being on the way to something unknown, something new. And yet it is the law of all progress that it is made by passing through some stages of instability, and that may take a very long time. Don't try to force, as though you could be today what time, that is to say grace and circumstances, will make of you tomorrow. Only God can say what this new spirit gradually forming will be. Accept the anxiety of feeling yourself in suspense and incomplete. May it be so for us. So just a note and a reminder that during our sharing times, when we are invited to share, you may click on a little icon. I believe for you it is hidden underneath the participants button, but it's somewhere on your screen. And you can click on it and you will be placed in a queue. And you will be called on and unmuted So you don't have to worry about the mute or unmute function yourself. Everyone present will hear you and will be able to see you. So now we prepare to enter into the time of Lectio Divina, to listen deeply and move into our inmost being and activate the spiritual senses to receive knowledge in the deepest parts of our intellectual center, to have our emotional center enlivened with valuation, and to have our bodies sense the truth and goodness of what is being offered, to receive all in order that we may manifest this word made flesh in our flesh. So please join me in moving into the present moment. Back upright, heart open. We hand over the complexities of our lives, knowing that they are opportunities for small deaths and small births. We stand unencumbered before God and one another. So I will share our Lectio Divina passage on the screen. It comes from today's email message, and I will read it three times. You may wish to read it along with me, to gaze on the image and see how it also informs you, or simply to close your eyes and listen. What is the word or idea or impression for my life now that is coming through this passage? For this command which I am giving you today is not too wondrous or remote for you. It is not in the heavens that you should say, "Who will go up to the heavens to get it for us and tell us of it that we may go?" Nor is it across the sea that you should say, "Who will cross the sea to get it for us and tell us of it that we may do it?" No, it is something very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, to do it. I have set before you life and death. Choose life that you may live. For this command which I am giving you today is not too wondrous or remote for you. It is not in the heavens that you should say, "Who will go up to the heavens to get it for us and tell us of it that we may do it?" Nor is it across the sea that you should say, "Who will cross the sea to give it for us? Get it for us and tell us of it that we may do it." No, it is something very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, to do it. I have set before you life and death. Choose life that you may live. For this command which I am giving you today is not too wondrous or remote for you. It is not in the heavens that you should say, who will go up to the heavens to get it for us and tell us of it, that we may do it. Nor is it across the sea that you should say, who will cross the sea to get it for us and tell us of it, that we may do it. No, it is something very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, to do it. I have set before you life and death. Choose life, that you may live. Amen. You are now invited to share what you receive from this passage. Yes, Kara.
I heard that you may live. And it made me think of my life before CCH, before the work, that I was truly a stimulus response automaton. But with the work, I've been able to engage active living, growing consciousness, growing my essence, to truly live. That's great freedom from that mechanicality. And I wish to truly live.
Indeed, Karen, thank you. JC.
There were two things that I heard. The first being in your mouth, which is a whole lot closer than up in the heavens. And the thought of the work idea of inner taste came to mind. So having an inner taste of the other part of what I heard was choose life, that you may live. And so the mouth being the very vulnerable, very soft entrance way into the human body that we take our food and sustenance in from, that these are impressions that we're taking in of choosing life. And the work idea that came to me there is, if you can't change it, will it? And so I talked to so many of the guys that I work with in recovery about choosing to live life from the inside out instead of being slapped around by external events and circumstances, and that is a function of the will. And so, you know, of course I'm going to choose life. What else would I choose? But I think there's a deeper meaning there, that when we recognize that as I am, I cannot change. As I am, I cannot change. External things I can't do, but I can will that I choose to participate in life and be a part of it. And the astonishing thing about this passage for me is that it comes from Deuteronomy, which I've always felt is a pretty dry book of laws. So it's pretty good food served up there.
Indeed. Thank you, JC. Thank you. Catherine.
Well, the overall passage to me spoke of a self-developing organism, personal responsibility. But I also heard the mouth and the heart as being ways that it's interior and close to us. And we talk about the making aim from more than one center and the necessity of having the emotional component and not just our mouth that's speaking something without, you know, the center's commitment to whatever it is we're making aim about, or you know, having our wish to be self-developing organisms. The part I'm left wondering with about the mouth is the role of speaking. And I guess it's a question of either doing it mechanically, just blabbing away, or whether it's, you know, a concerted affirmation when we're using it. I guess I liked JC's offering about inner taste. We taste to see whether the mouth is helping us or going on unconsciously. Thanks.
Thank you, Catherine. Indeed, the work says many interesting things about talking. So, Jack and Jackie.
Yes, can you hear me?
Very low.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
I heard inner parts of center, and that it actually is not all that miraculous or special, but it's very personal, that it is not in projecting off on others, which we are habitually accustomed to doing. It is not about events out there or even events in our outer parts of centers. It is a very personal inner relationship with God and the Spirit, and apparently has been for very, very long.
Indeed. Thank you, Jackie. We have time for a few more. I'm certain that someone heard something that we all would benefit from hearing. Judith, did you wish to say something?
Duberly's hand is up, Marianne.
Yes, Duberly.
Can you all hear me?
Yes, thank you, Duberly.
I heard, I have set before you life and death. I can't help but think the situation we're in together, and how the apparent slowdown doesn't feel like a slowdown. And I feel pressure, and I can't tell if the pressure is coming from the outside in or from the inside out. But I can tell, I can feel that this choice between life and death is every second almost. Every time I move, I have that choice.
Indeed. Thank you, Duberly. Todd.
I also heard the part about I set before you death and life, and I was reminded of, in the work terms, when people are dead, they're asleep and mechanical. And when, you know, and being alive is being, is waking up. And that was what came to me about the, you know, choose life, choose to wake up. The other part had to do with being in your, being immediate, the, you know, that it's right here. It's not in the heavens. It's not across the sea. It's very, it's in your own mouth. It's in your own heart. And, you know, that's one thing about the work to me is it's just impracticality. The, it's so right here and now, practical, immediate. And I was reminded of that as well. That's what I got.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Todd. Thank you. Catherine, do you see Catherine Kuchar? Catherine, could you lose a little button on your screen?
I can't find the raise.
She's ready. She's ready.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Please go ahead.
I heard choose life. And when I thought of it, and you know, I heard it again, I heard it as choose to work. And when I work, there's consciousness. And when I have consciousness, I have life. And it's not waiting across the seas for it to come to me. And when I heard in your heart and in your mouth, it was a reminder the work is inside. It's not across the seas. So it was just, it was really nice to hear choose to work, choose life.
To work. Yes. Thank you, Catherine. So thank you, everyone, for all of your sharings, for all that we received, both that which is spoken and that which lies deeper in our hearts. So this evening, as we move into the second phase of our time together, we will move from the topic of conscience from 2 weeks ago through the Easter message to this week's vast topic of self-observation, which is never-ending in its unfolding mysteries. And in order to lead us in this work, I am very pleased to introduce Donald Janung, who will take us on this journey of discovery. Donald.
Thank you, Marianne. So we do have 2 weeks of work exercise, a rare opportunity to cover both of those. And I'm going to take just a moment and share my screen with you so we can catch up on what was offered 2 weeks ago and also what is offered last week. So 2 weeks ago, we had a beautiful teaching. So the email for that week was exquisite on acquired and real conscience. And the homework exercise is on the screen now to begin to observe acquired conscience as it manifests the lie of separation. In the light of the work, we can ask ourselves, instead of pointing the finger at the other, how can I externally consider and see the same pattern in myself? And work with memory to heal the past. Well, we could spend all night probably on the last one, work with memory to heal the past. Because those who say that you cannot change the past have just never done it. And through the work, we can clearly change the past. But it starts with what we had talked about above that. Observe acquired conscience and how it manifests and how what it is I see in the other person mysteriously that I'm so disturbed about is actually very clearly an aspect of my own psychology. So do we have any sharings that we'd like to clear out on that? Anything to anchor outside of ourselves? Well, you're formulating some of the things that might have happened a couple weeks ago. It was interesting that I had a conversation with someone just a couple days ago who said, can I talk to you for a moment? There's something about somebody that is just bugging me terribly. And the work says it's in me, but I just can't see it. And you just listen patiently and wait and allow the Holy Spirit to reveal it. But self-observation will reveal it. And it is such an irony that something that is so bothersome about somebody else is actually an aspect of my personality that I haven't yet observed. Suzanne, what do you have to offer here?
This is slightly a different take because I was reading the commentaries and I can't find the notes about it, but it was basically my observing of myself sometimes when I'm interacting with my daughter or my husband. And I have this thought, like when I'm being really bossy or just not being, just ordering people around or something, or being not thinking about myself as other people would see me in that moment. So I'm observing myself, but really thinking about, oh my God, what if the people at church would see me right now? I am just so horrible. And it's not about how horrible I'm being. It's about, oh my God, if somebody catches me being this way, what would they think of me? And the reading was a little bit about that when I started to read that. And it really made me think about, okay, well, what is my motivation here? Am I really motivated by outside, what other people view of me versus what's really going on here, which is I'm not being very kind or nice or loving right now. And that's what I got out of that reading.
Thank you, Suzanne. Yeah, it's nice that you have the opportunity to say that to yourself. Oh my goodness, if people at the church could only see me right now. Often we have our partners to say that for us. Brett, thank you.
Yeah, actually, I don't have anything to add. I just saw that Judith London had her hand up several times. And so I just wanted to pass the mic over to her. And if anybody wants to raise your hand, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I had to click on participants. And then at the bottom of that pop-up box, it says raise hand. I'm working on a laptop on a Mac, so it might be a little different from others, but Judith.
Good to be with you, Brett. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Go ahead, Judith.
Thank you. Thank you, Brett. Ed and I live in an RV. It's about 300 square feet, 120 of which is the upper level, which is the bedroom and bath. So in 200 square feet, in shelter in place, it's like living in a submarine, especially when it's raining outside. And things in real life that go by as little picadillos or little irritations suddenly grow in volume and mass when you're that close. And I've really felt the sandpapering, and the light is fully on my unkindnesses. For example, one category is dumb questions. Okay, so Ed will say, honey, where's the paper towel? Where are the paper towels? Okay, so the immediate mechanical response is, did you look? You know, which leaves the needle at zero. And doesn't taste good at all. I wish to be kind to Ed because that's what he deserves, and I love him, and the taste is so awful when I am not. Even a response that sounds kind, like, even the intonation, will have barnacles on it, like sarcasm or judgment. The real answer is they're in the cabinet above the printer. It's clean. There's nothing sticky about it. And it's the way I should respond. In the morning, I have to set that aim. I wish to be kind to Ed today. Wish none of my responses to be mechanical. And if I set that aim in more than one center, it serves me well. So Eckhart Tolle said that the darker it is out, the more light there is. It's this two sides of the same coin. And when it's really, really black, you can count on the fact that Holy Spirit is in full force. And I hold that thought, and I hold it on behalf of everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Yes, Duberly.
Of separation, I noticed that I've always pointed my finger. I live in Westlake, which is a very well-off neighborhood in Austin, for those of you who don't know. And I noticed that I've always pointed my finger at people who live in Westlake, even though I live in Westlake, that there was a pretentiousness about them, or that I put on them for the fancy cars they drive and the fancy vacations they take. And it dawned on me with this homework that I drive a fancy car, and that I am, by definition, somebody who lives in Westlake. And it also occurred to me that there are eyes in me that have been there for a long time that believe that it's better to be poor and humble than it is to be privileged. And that was the separation. And that I am privileged, that I've gone to college and I live in a nice house. And there's guilt around that. And that guilt is the one that's causing this lie in me, that makes me look at other people that are privileged. If it wasn't for this privilege of mine, I don't know that I would have become a good householder. and would have gotten to this place where I'm with you guys right now. So I'm thankful for that in more ways than one.
Yeah. Very good, Dooley. Thank you so much for your honesty and anchoring that outside yourself. Jackie.
Oh, I didn't hear any of the very first part of the service. I was grousing because I was trying to eat my Santa Catarina cold Mexican food. And Jackie had the wherewithal to come in here to the class. And I was just in a funk, and I went out to take the garbage out. Instead of coming here and absorbing these impressions, this food. And when I went out, our neighbors, they're in their late 70s. She started Toy Joy, and he's a Hawaiian artist. Haven't seen him for a few days. But they had strung two strings of Lama Foundation flags, the same flags that are in the teen room, the same flags that I saw it there when we were at Lama, and that impression shocked me and brought me back to center, and came right back in and sat down. And I am so thankful that I have these moments when I can juxtapose being totally internally considering and totally negative and in the grips of eyes that don't like the work, and be able to join in with my brothers and sisters in this extraordinary teaching, healing teaching. This is a much better food than cold Santa Catarina food and the food of my associations. I'm thankful to all of y'all, and you, Donald.
Yeah. Thank you, Jack. Yeah. You bring up a very good point there, too, with the eyes that do not like the work. And as we talk more and investigate more self-observation, that is a very important place for us to give our attention to, the eyes that do not like the work. And also take a moment of gratitude, too, that in a partnership, that you had a moment there where we're not both crazy at the same time, that somebody had high valuation and life was talking to you and you listened, and here we are together. Thank you, Jack and Jackie. Pamela, I can see the two hands are raised, but I don't know who they are.
Tracy, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to see everybody. I was observing my aspects of my acquired conscience. And the first thing that I saw was the fear and the lack of control that I've been experiencing since this pandemic. feeling more lack of control than usual, and really feeling into the desire to do something, but being unable to do so. I also observed a contradiction throughout the week of faith that God loves me, He loves all of us, and He had this whole thing under control. But the contradiction and the forces between those two, the only thing that came to me was to hold both as opposites and to acknowledge both as part of my acquired conscience and part of truth. And throughout the week, just wishing for God and love to win. So that was my experience in observing aspects of my acquired conscience.
Thank you, Tracy. We wish that for you and for ourselves as well.
Thank you.
Billy, please.
Can you hear me okay? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So around this idea, I found myself incredibly infuriated when I was listening to one of the a news report. And it was, I think, the day that the CDC had said everybody needed, was recommended that everyone should be wearing masks, but that it was voluntary. And Trump said he wasn't going to wear one. And I was utterly infuriated. I mean, infuriated. Like I wanted to run outside and just scream because of that. And I suddenly, you know, started thinking, you know, why in this country do we think that we're immune to things, or we're better, or we're superior, or it's not going to happen to us. All this denial, 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 denial. And then I remembered, took me a while to remember this because I had to, you know, cool down a bit, that on travels that I have made to India, Nepal, Tibet, where people routinely wear masks every day out of consideration for others. It's just a cultural norm. And rarely, rarely when I was there, did I put on a mask. So this whole thing about Trump saying he wasn't going to wear one was, it was a very bright mirror on my own behavior in years past of denying that it couldn't happen to me. I don't need to wear one. I guess that's good enough.
Thank you, Billy. Jan Brown, please.
Hi, everybody. So, and hi, Donald.
Hello, Jan.
It's good to see everybody. I'm in Santa Fe now. I'm sure I've said that before, but all this time that we're sheltered in place has given me a lot of time to be with myself and not have those distractions. And so I see these. The only person I interface with is my sister. I mean, one-on-one, you know, that we still touch each other and kiss. But most of the time I'm by myself. And so I know this. I know that what I see in somebody else is in myself. And the time by myself has given me, unfortunately, more opportunity to see that. And what I notice is when I'm like that, in all three centers, I'm like that. I got all the crap going on in my head and my stomach's tight and I'm a wreck. And if I go out and like I'll see my sister, I don't feel like I want to be around her. I'm like shooting out daggers of anger. And then on the other hand, I notice when that feeling, when that part of Jan is not doing that, that my whole self feels open to love. I mean, I feel so, it's like physically, emotionally, mentally, I feel like a totally different person. I feel like I'm, you know, by this far, you know, whatever, this far in the work, whatever. Sometimes I think I shouldn't be doing this. And then when those eyes take a hold of me, it's just disconcerting and it ruins my time. Anyway, that's it.
Thank you, Jan. During our time of sharing here of our homework, I also want to make sure that we've got a little bit of time for the impressions that landed on us from our Easter reflections. and how practicing resurrection looked for us. So if anyone has any insights they'd like to share on that, we'd like to hear from you as well. Pamela, I can't see any hands, so I'm going to leave it up to you. Yeah, Lori, thank you.
Hi, good evening. Mine is kind of both. What I saw, and I shared this with my journey group, had to do with a memory. And similar to what Billy said, I have seen myself judge people in the news for being bullies. And I had a memory, and I it's not something that was a normal thing for me as a young person, but in high school, there was an incident where I actually and another girl bullied a boy, a young man. And he actually ended up crying. And in looking back on that, I could see that younger self as being afraid, as being, we were supposed to be working on a project together and I didn't think that he was doing it right. And so there was this feeling of wanting of that I was going to be judged badly. And there's the acquired conscience that I was going to be, that he was going to cause me to get a bad grade. And it was very important to do it right. It was very important to be seen as good. And so I did go back and I did use directed imagination to talk to her, that younger I, and tell her that everything was all right and that it all turned out all right and that she has a basic core of goodness. And I also talked to him and I said, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And you are loved and you have a basic core of goodness. And so that was a resurrection for me. That was the ability to actually energetically go back to these moments where we see in our past that we did not behave, whether it's in high school or yesterday, that we did not behave as we would have wanted to because of the multiplicity or just because of sleep, to go back and to be able to offer consciousness and to offer compassion to ourselves and others is, to me, quite a resurrection experience.
Thank you, Lori, for that really good example of changing the experience of the past. Much appreciated. Anna?
Anna, you're on. Let's go to Carly then.
Thank you, Pamela.
I'm just feeling so moved by everyone sharing. Wow. I had a really interesting Easter experience where a place where my eyes have really gotten caught in my life is feeling like I have let down my family and feeling like I wasn't able to protect my children in ways I wanted to protect them, whether it was from pain or suffering, some of it within my own family. And when one of my daughters was in high school, she was in a very abusive relationship. And companioning her through that was, as you can imagine, excruciating. And so this was about 5 years ago. And if you had asked her to talk about this gentleman, she kind of referred to him as a devil and other not so polite terms. And it was something that I had held in my heart for a long time, that there would be healing for her and also for him. Mm-hmm. Because I could see how both of them were caught up in some ways in forces that were so much bigger than them. And my daughter came, we had a little just Easter dinner with our family, my children and husband, and she came and she said, "You're not going to believe this, but I heard from this gentleman. And he reached out because he wants to apologize." And she said, "I never thought he would apologize." She was just in shock. And what came to me through this experience, I don't know if any of you have had that experience of praying for something for so many years and for so long, something that you just yearn for healing in your family line and for the people you love. And this is something that I had prayed and prayed for, that everyone could be freed from those strands of guilt that everyone carried, the strands of guilt I carried, the strands of guilt he carried, the strands of shame and pain that she carried. And what an Easter gift. And it was interesting, my other daughter said, the first thing that actually came to me when she told me is like, "You have been given such a gift." Like, what a gift. And to both make room for all her feelings and her anger and should I forgive him, and but also to hold that space of, this could really free your heart. This could free your heart. And she ended up talking with him and accepting his apology and forgiving him. And you could just, if you've had that moment, you can just feel the dissolving of that chain where it just goes. Like, I can feel it going back generations in my family. I could feel it going forward. And I was so grateful for his courage that enabled him to come forward. And all I could think for the rest of the day was, I just wanted to bless him, like, bless you, bless you, bless you, bless you. All the anger I had carried towards him, all the guilt I carried within myself, all the sadness, all the grief, it just, I could feel it just move to bless, 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 like, go in peace and thank you. Thank you for coming. And it was such a profound moment of resurrection. And just that, I keep thinking of what Tim said, our sincere prayers are always answered. Love is stronger than the shame and the guilt and the suffering and, you know. So it's such a blessing. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Carly, for your prayers. And may we both continue, may we all continue just to bless life in all its different ways of being shown, of being lived. Thank you. Let's finish with Jill.
Well, my father died on Palm Sunday, and the Sunday before that, he had pretty much slipped into unconsciousness, but he was still saying some things and coming in and out. And I've told some of you this, but he was present between my mom and I for Sunday service the week before he died in his hospital bed. And he hadn't said anything that morning. But after the service, with his eyes closed, he said, "Well, that was very effective." And my mom and I kind of looked at him, and then he said something about Jill, and he said something about what I did, and he said, "She's a good girl." And in that moment, there was so much healing, and I realized that that was something that he and I were different in a lot of ways, and we were so much alike, so much alike. I'm a chip off the old block as far as a lot of qualities. And what I realized is I burst into tears when he said that, and I realized how deep that was, that so much of my story, my acquired conscience, has been that I'm not a good girl, that I haven't been, that, and I've worked my butt off trying to be, and spent a lot of energy in that way. And it was so freeing in that moment. And the externally considering came because once I was free of that idea that I wasn't a good girl, that I didn't, then I realized what a good father he was. And he lived for another week, and most of it he was not conscious. But every day, many times, every time I could, I got near his ear and I said, "You're a good daddy." And I told him all the things that that I knew, how good he was. And I felt like he didn't know I was listening when he said that to me. And it was so important for me to share that blessing with him, like Carly said, just to keep telling him. And what I know about acquired conscience is that it's not real and that it falls away, because everything fell away that was not love. And I can tell you the things we didn't agree on, but they don't exist in me anymore. All there is love, and it's done. And I feel like if he gave that to me with that, I pray that I blessed him with that in his last week on this plane and into eternity, for both of us to know the truth that we are good. And in God's eyes, that's all we can be. And that we knew that in the end was just resurrection. Yes.
Thank you, Jill. Resurrection indeed. A glorious Easter for your family. Yeah, thank you. Well, let's continue our conversations as we go into a little bit deeper the topic of the week of self-observation. And we know that the work begins with work on the side of knowledge. And before we begin self-observation, we've got to do some work on the side of knowledge to know what it is to observe. In one of the commentaries I remember reading, Nickel was talking about what the experience would be like if someone said, "Go into this large department store and observe it." And the person that would go in and observe it would come out totally confused because there wasn't any direction on what to observe. I remember my first introduction to the work, sitting at night, having a conversation with Tim, and telling him how I was really attracted to the ideas of the work, but I didn't know what I would have to work on because, you know, things were so good in my life. And I went on to tell him all the good things in my life. And he just sat there very patiently and grinned. And he said, "Well, first you've got some things to learn. And then when you're ready and you begin self-observation, the work will show you the rest." And boy, was he right about that. So on the ideas of self-observation, what is it that we need to observe? And what is the experience of self-observation? This week's writing was really, really good and introduced us to some very helpful ideas about what the experience of self-observation is. Because self-observation is the development of an inner sense. one that many of us, that probably all of us that have made efforts towards developing observing eye, have had the experience of looking back on our life and saying, oh my gosh, how did I not know this? How did I not have this experience before? Where was this information? How did I not get this? And what we wonder what life would have been like if we would have learned self-observation when we were younger. So the ideas of self-observation that are highlighted in this week's email are really profound. I'm going to bring some of them up on the screen right now. Self-observation is an act of attention directed inwards to what's going on in you. So although it's useful to observe what we may look like in the world, the better starting place for self-observation is to look inward and recognize that we're really interested in our psychology, in that invisible energy force, that operating system that we have. And I've gained quite a bit through self-observation of listening to the way I walk and being very surprised to hear that there's a little stutter step, almost like a little hip-hop step in my walk. Watch myself brushing my teeth. Watch myself driving and how clenched my hands are. There's a lot of things we can see on the outside, but initially we're interested in directed attention inwards. And the second bullet point, that attention must be active, that is directed. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. This attention cannot be passive. And the attention comes from the observed side. So here the work is saying that we need to separate our experience of ourselves into two, an observed side and that which is observed. So we've got the side of observation where thoughts and emotions belong to that side. And then we have the experience of observing ourselves. And the saying that man is first one, then two, then one. The observing side or observing eye stands interior or above the observed side, but its power of independent consciousness varies because it may be submerged at any moment. And how true that is when we begin self-observation and then we realize how easy it is for us to lose our attention in self-observation, especially when we've seen something that gets our attention and gets our interest and gets other eyes active. All this is quite different from merely knowing what is negative. That's a passive knowing and can be said to be mechanical, in contrast to self-observation, which is a conscious act and cannot become mechanical. Mechanical self-observation has nothing to do with work self-observation. And the final bullet point from this week's message that came out today, the email that came out today, the self-observation brings about a complete change of the feeling of oneself and begins to dissolve imaginary I. So we'll stop there for just a moment and with the reminder that the energy that is tied up in an I, in an identification, that energy through self-observation, we begin to see that and separate from it, we begin to have a free flow of energy that now we can do something divine with. And so it's saying we have a really different experience of one self, and the dissolving of imaginary I is a very real experience. And at the same time, while the process is taking place, we begin to feel the influences reaching us from another source of meaning. What might that other source of meaning be? These influences could not reach us before because there was a thick darkness intervening. Yeah. So in other words, if we look at this as a radio station and there's a particular station that we want to listen to, but we can't get it frequently because we're tuned into something different, a different frequency of a different eye that is, we're identified, our attention's in the wrong place, we're not going to get the station, we're not going to get the transmission that we truly wish for. I think that's what it's saying when it's talking about that there's a thick darkness intervening. So the idea of attention comes up, and it is a very, very important one. So I'm going to bring up a quick chart here. And for those of you that have commentaries, you'll find this right around page 76 of your commentary. And we have to remember that the work is saying that the work gives us this picture of calling us a three-storied house. And in the top story, the third story, is the intellectual center. The second story, the middle story, is the emotional center. And the bottom story is the moving instinctive center. And the work says that there's an attention that will tell us what center we're in, and not only that, but what part of the center we're in. So in this idea, when it said that our self-observations need to be directed attention, I want to give you a little bit of a picture on this. Now, in the moving part of the intellectual center, that's the mechanical part. That's the part when we're there, we need no attention at all. It's mechanical. When we begin to have an attracted attention, we're getting more internal now. Now we're beginning to come awake to ourselves, and we're in the emotional part of the center. And with that experience of the emotional part of the center, all it is that we need to do is to keep out distractions, to have an experience of directed attention there. Now, the intellectual part of each center, the innermost part, is the place where directed attention is. For those who have been in the work for a while and you've had experiences of really violent eyes, and we've observed them and it gets to the point where we just can't free ourselves from them. We are so invested in them that even outside distractions won't break us free from those, that eye. You can begin to get an idea of what that directed attention is like. Likewise, if you're a musician perhaps, or an artist, or you're working on doing code, and you feel like you're in a tunnel of attention, this is the experience of directed attention. When you have that, you know, oh, well, I must be in an intellectual part of center. And then it becomes much easier for us to begin to check the experience of ourselves as to whether that nebula of energy is in the intellectual part of our center, or whether it's emotional, or whether it's in our body. Now we can go through and look at the emotional center and see the same thing. That there's a moving part of the center which requires no attention of our own whatsoever. It's mechanical. There is an emotional part which requires, it's an attracted attention. And here, it's very common for us to have religious emotions, aesthetic emotions, etc. And again, in this part of center, the emotional part of the center, all we need to do is keep out distractions. We probably watch a lot of movies. We listen to music probably in that center. We probably type up emails and things like that in this center. And then again, in the emotional center, we have the intellectual part, and that is where the directed attention comes in. Okay, so in the summary of attention, and I'm going to include this with the class notes that will be posted on the archives page for tonight's class, so you'll be able to see this there as well for review. But it talks about the three experiences of attention: zero attention in the moving parts of our centers, the second, attracted attention, all we need to do is keep out distractions, irrelevant things, and an attention in the intellectual parts of centers that must be directed by effort and will. And then there's a little summary on it. So what do we know about self-observation? Well, the work says that we need to observe in all three centers. We need to observe with every opportunity the thoughts that are going through with a particular eye. And let's take a minute and say, let's say the experience of being agitated. You say, okay, I can see my thoughts are very agitated. I've got agitated thoughts. The thought train is not moving smoothly. It's moving from remembering things to imagining things to comparing this to contrasting that and doing the things that the intellectual center does. So with a particular agitated thought, I can see how I'm agitated at something. Then I observe the experience of my emotional center. It's like, feel this agitation. I've got the feeling of agitation in me. And that feeling is sometimes often given to us by observing our moving center. What are the sensations in our body that show agitation? The fourth component is, now that I've observed it in all three centers, is I need to give it a name. This giving it a name is a really big deal. And a useful picture is like when you see a dog going down the street that you know is a neighborhood dog, but you haven't seen that dog. You don't know the dog's name. You don't know what family it goes to, but you know what it looks like, and you see the thoughts of the dog, and you feel, nice doggy, good dog. And your body gets a little happy because there's this nice doggy walking past your house along the driveway. But then one day you learn that that dog's name is Spot. Now, from now on, when you see the dog, there's a different experience of it because it's Spot. The idea of this is we don't have to continue to recapitulate the same observation of the same eyes. And it is so helpful to name the eye. So that's the fourth step in the self-observation. Now, the fifth one is a recognition that when we're observing eyes in ourselves, quite frequently we'll observe also that there's a presence of a critic in there. And then the critic is often going to have some commentary on the eye. Oh, you're agitated again. And you call yourself a work student. Don't you think you should be over this right now? Have you not been working? And it just goes on and on. A word of caution there from my own personal experience, and that is recognize the critic, but don't let the critic get you off the hunt. Because it is kind of like a game of freeze tag sometimes inside, where something is frozen and you want to try to freeze it, to unfreeze it, and you get over to it, and then you're tagged and you've lost, and now you're frozen too. The critic can be kind of like that in us. So my experience is just to recognize the critic. I kind of almost give it a little bit of a wink and say, okay. And then once I've completed my observation, I want to move on to the second step. But the second step is not this week. This week is the self-observation. So we're going to have the experience a little bit with self-observation of observing these eyes in us, this doctrine of eyes, these many eyes. This was one of the very difficult things for me to get my head around early on in the work, because I truly did see myself as one consistent person, me. And when Tim said, you got some things to learn. And then once you start working on the side of being, putting these ideas into motion by practicing them, the work will show you some things. And that the person that I thought was one single person, unchanged person, was an extraordinary illusion that the work presented. And it presents it also usually by a little help from your friends. In this particular case, my biggest work awakening was when somebody told me some things about myself that I had no idea about. And it helped it that this person told me those things in public in front of about 70 people. The work has this great thing that says, verify everything for yourself. So I started verifying. I started asking people, my mom, some siblings, people I used to work with, neighbors. And I was so surprised that everyone had the same experience of me, but it wasn't the same experience that I was having of myself. It was shocking. And one of the ways I took myself is as being a very honest man. You're not a dishonest man. You're not a liar. And when the work says that it will give you what you need at the right time, the right place, but you'll never get more than what you can handle, that is really for sure. So I began to get enough feedback that it convinced me, without a doubt, that the experience that I had of myself as this one unchanging person was clearly an illusion. Everybody else was having a very consistent experience of me, and it wasn't the one I was having of myself. It was hell. And it was crazy making for a while, but in a good way. Because there was all of this confusion and energy that was available, and the work has a way to utilize that once we know what to do with it. And we'll talk more about that next week. But self-observation can be very painful. And it is really helpful if we do our self-observation completely and we do it right from the start. I can honestly say that a lot of my self-observations did not have the observation of my moving center, the experience of my body in it, which is really odd considering that my personality type is a 1-3-2 man. So the moving center is the primary center, the intellectual center second, and the least developed is the emotional center. Well, how is it I wasn't able to really include the moving center in my observations? I've come to learn that it would have been very good to have done this because it can really shortcut the process extraordinarily. You can see agitation in yourself so quickly. You can see irritation in yourself. You can see impatience. And the body is usually the fastest litmus test of letting us know these things. Now, the intellectual center, it's constantly comparing and contrasting, recording information, retrieving information, etc. The emotions, very difficult sometimes to put a name on. The body will tell you so quickly what it is you're experiencing. So the encouragement is to utilize your observations by going to observing each center and its activity and its experience in an eye, name the eye, and then be alert to the critic that usually will have a little commentary about what it is that you're observing. Another important thing that we could benefit from remembering about the experience of observing eye is observing eye doesn't judge. It simply sees what it sees. No judgment. If you know there's judgment going on, you say, oh, okay, this is something else. I'm observing, but there's something else in here. We want to be alert to that. So let's take a moment and see if this has brought up anything for anyone that you'd like to talk about for just a moment, your experience of self-observation. Anything you might be able to add? We have a few minutes to talk about it. Yeah, Camille, thank you.
I had an experience this past weekend of my moving center and how it got a real cramp in it because the parks were all closed. And I have gotten in the habit of riding my bicycle several times a week out at the Veloway. I live south, and the Veloway is out south. And so it's just a real convenient place for me to ride without having to worry at all about traffic. And it was closed over the Easter weekend. And I was just in the pits. I was in hell because I couldn't get out there. I couldn't walk my dog in the area that I normally walk her. And, you know, I could certainly get out and walk around my neighborhood, but it was not the same at all. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize this until later on in the weekend, until Saturday, we'll say, after I'd had a whole day of being cooped up. At least that's how I felt. And then on Sunday, I realized that the parks were going to be open the next day. And it was like I had a resurrection experience, just looking forward to that ability to get out and do the activities that I wanted to do in a beautiful, beautiful environment. And I know that sounds so trite compared to all the other things people have said tonight, but at that time, I realized that my moving center probably is my number one center. And I hadn't thought that before, but it has to be. But there's the need for that beauty of nature, because riding a stationary bicycle in my house or doing exercises in my house wouldn't be the same at all. So I'm not sure if that's moving and emotional center or what that is, but it truly did feel like a resurrecting experience.
Thank you, Camille. Hopefully we have some time next week to talk about how to neutralize the experience in the different centers when they become very profound. And it is not a small trite thing. I appreciate everything that you said. Tom, we've got one time for Tom, and we'll need to close right after you have what you need to say, Tom.
I don't know. I have my camera off, so maybe I should start the video. But one thing I notice about when I really and truly self-observe either a feeling or an action, it not only informs me, but it interrupts the action. I don't know if that's always the case, but with me, it always happens that way. If I'm really self-observing, then it puts a stop to it at that moment. It allows me to remember it, but it stops the behavior at that time.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, there is the Heisenberg principle there, that our observation does change what is happening. Thank you, Tom. Okay. Well, let's take a moment and look at what our exercise is going to be for next week. And this is our homework. When evoked, observe sources of blame or the dislike of another. Observe in three centers. What are my thoughts, feelings, and sensations around this thing, event, and person? Consider writing them down, referring to oneself in the third person. That is, X is thinking this, feeling this, seeing this. Referring to oneself in the third person can bring separation and facilitate self-observation and non-identification. And if you're already doing this often, consider letting go of the practice for now and focus on digestion of the impression in a new way through practicing the first conscious shock, bringing a work idea up to the place of an incoming impression. Amen.
Thank you, Donald. We have a closing word from Rodney Collin. Two men were going home when they met the master. Without recognizing him, he accompanied them on the road and taught them. When they arrived at Emmaus, he entered their house and revealed himself as the divine master. Those of us who go by the fourth way meet the master without recognizing him, and he teaches us. If we invite him into our house, he will manifest himself to us. For this to happen, it is necessary that we should be at home, that is, to be present in ourselves. And may it be so. Let us join together in praying the prayer of God's love aloud wherever we are and affirming its truth. God's love has met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake. Watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. Amen. Good night.